So I hope it will be clear what you can do by simply combining basically publicly available evidence and also eliciting the help of other people in filling in the gaps or basically changing your whole story if some parts of it may be wrong. We have time for questions, so let's open the floor. Are there questions? We have a microphone as well.
I don't speak Turkish or Azerbaijan, so how are we going to get the news from those areas?
That's an excellent question. And I think that the answer is that I do not speak Turkish or Azerbaijani or Armenian or Neo-Botanian Aramaic or any of these other languages as well, which obviously prevents a significant impediment, as you say, to following these stories. In fact, I mean, as you can see, I can barely manage with the pronunciation of some of these names, which is a significant impediment. If I, for example, was claiming to be the authority on this subject, you must listen to me, I know everything there is to know, my claim is almost precisely the opposite. Not that I know nothing, but that I understand the limits of my knowledge when it comes to this. And so there are certain sources out there that would directly pertain to the study of this that are not easily available to myself or yourself and others. Which is why I think the principle of open source investigation is so important, because in the Corbett Report community, for example, and that's just one tiny, tiny, tiny community at the moment, it's consisting of several hundred people around the world who speak different languages and can, I mean, there are Turkish speakers, for example, in the community, who could source some of those types of documents and bring them to the table. The problem, I know, the frustration is that we want to be able to access all of this directly, and realistically, for myself, for a lot of people, that's not going to be possible. So it does rely on faith in a process that is not orderly, it is not predictable, it is not something that we can ever ultimately conclude. I don't think with this report or any of the reports that I've ever filed at the Corbett Report, I have come to the definitive conclusion of the truth, and you must listen to me. I think it's always a work in progress that can be supplemented by more information that's brought to the table by other members of the community. That's what I'm trying to attempt to create at the Corbett Report as an example, but obviously not as, again, I don't think that the Corbett Report will be the one place that everyone should go. I mean, it's just one example that hopefully we'll be able to get Turkish speakers and Azerbaijani speakers and all sorts of people with different pieces of this puzzle to come together. And it's in people dropping the pieces of the puzzle on the table that each person, I think individually, will have to sort through those pieces and see how they fit into a puzzle picture. And I think different people will put those puzzle pieces together in different ways. So again, it's the question of whether or not there is a central authority that's going to be able to do this. And I certainly, personally, can't, and I don't imagine anyone in this room can assemble all of these, or collect all of these pieces of the puzzle. It is a combined effort, and there are frustrations that go along with that, but hopefully my faith is in this remarkable technology that we have at our disposal now to bring together millions, billions of people across the globe, ultimately, in an investigation that if, again, if the public is knowledgeable and motivated about these issues, which, again, is a tall order, but if they are, I think there really is an incredible amount of potential in the crowd assembled in this room alone, let alone the crowd out there in cyberspace, to be able to bring those pieces together, which is a very long and philosophical answer to your question, but I think goes to my part of that response.
Is it too far-fetched to suggest that the goings-on in the Ukraine and the goings-on around ISIL are connected to this story?
I don't think far-fetched would be the word I would use, no. Regardless of the actual specific connections we can find between people or events that connect those different stories, I think that the underlying idea that we pointed out in this presentation, the strategy of tension, is something that is employed in multiple fields of operation, not necessarily by the same, not by Operation Gladio or anything related to NATO, but just as a tool of psychological manipulation. So that, for example, Islamic State and things like that can be seen as one example of a potential, I mean, again, we have to put out the different pieces that would lay this out, but a potentially a part of a strategy of tension, which I actually did do in a recent podcast episode in some of my recent interviews, laid out some of those pieces of the puzzle of the Islamic State, which are really fascinating because they talk about the different parts of the Islamic State's past that are never brought up. It's talked about as an organization that suddenly sprang out of nowhere a few years ago in Syria. It did not. It sprang out of specifically a Jordanian militant Sunni Muslim in 1999, and it eventually morphed into Al-Qaeda in Iraq. And some of the incredible exploits of the original founder of this group, including being killed on multiple occasions and being arrested on multiple occasions and all sorts of craziness like that, again, paint a picture of something very different than what we've been told about Islamic State. So I think that there probably is actual connections that we can paint between this story and that story, including, of course, Ayman al-Zawahiri, who plays a role in al-Qaeda, al-Qaeda in Iraq, Islamic State. There are definitely connections that we could start to draw out there. But again, regardless of those connections, I think the overall idea, we want to be involved in a region for whatever reason. We want to topple this government, or we want to send forces over here. If a problem is created, then we have the excuse to act in that manner. And that's exactly the type of strategy that was employed in the Gladio operations that has been documented, again, ably by many different researchers, and which I think we have to keep in mind when we're examining these events.
All right, let me see. I saw a question there.
Hello, James. Thank you for coming. I wanted to ask, in the Gladio operation, they've also used, National Socialists as people to work for them and commit some of these bombings. I was wondering if you think there's Nazis at the top of the Gladio organizations, or they're just used as pawns? And thank you.
Yes, thank you. Good question. Well, there's a lot of different things to parse out there, including how we would even define a Nazi. I mean, for example, Richard Cottrell in his work points to Lyman Lemnitzer as one of the key proponents of this Gladio operation, one of the people who put it together. And I don't know, I mean, depending how we define that idea of what a Nazi means, I think Lyman Lemnitzer might fall in line with that. But with regards to the actual self-identified National Socialists who were part of these covert operations, I think there is, I think we can look at, for example, the Pan-Turkish movement and how, and their relation to the NATO operation that they knew they were a part of and were cooperating with. I think each side in that relationship has its own idea of what they're going to get out of that relationship and how far that relationship can go. But the question of who is in control of that relationship, I would say that the preponderance of resources and ability to act throughout the world, let alone throughout any individual region, would be on the NATO side of that equation, which means that the Pan-Turkish movement, I mean, clearly, at the end of this operation was discarded, more or less. You have Ergenekon and other things that have sprung up in Turkey. But I think the NATO backing of that was clearly taken off at some point, and the Pan-Turkish movement obviously hasn't realized its goals. So I think they were used in that sense. And I wouldn't say that they were at the top of this organization because of that. Again, that's speculation from the outside, but I think it's informed speculation.
All right, question there. Here we go. A little bit that way.
Hi. I was astounded by Brzezinski's comment. I don't remember the exact comment, but it was something to the extent that strategies for global dominance are no longer effective because of the internet, because of social media, stuff like that. Mm. So on the one hand, we have him making this claim, and on the other hand, we do still see signs of these strategies for global dominance being implemented. So what do you make of his comment?
That's a very, very good question, because it points to Brzezinski's, I think, if not change, well, I think evolving views throughout this. We look today at his comments from the 1997 book, The Grand Chessboard, which in that section on the Eurasian Balkans, it should be noted, he concludes that rather than hard military power as a way to project American dominance of the region, soft power is needed, and he makes some claim towards that effect. Later in, I believe, 2004, he pens an entire book that's more about the use of soft power and its role in the 21st century. So it's not necessarily that Brzezinski himself was openly advocating for some sort of covert operation or some sort of military dominance of the region. And that points to a split in ideas about how American or other types of military dominance or psychological dominance or cultural dominance can be projected, which is interesting because in 2007, I believe it was 2007, Zbigniew Brzezinski was testifying at the Senate Foreign Relations Committee about the possibility that a bombing would happen in the United States and would be blamed on Iran, that was his phrasing, would be blamed on Iran in order to justify an invasion of Iran. To announce to someone who knows what is happening there, that sounds awfully like Zbigniew Brzezinski warning about the possibility of a false flag attack being used as a justification for a military incursion into another part of the globe, which, again, I think points to an interesting schism. Again, we can look at all of these people, for example, on the U.S.-Azerbaijan Chamber of Commerce and assume that they are all the same and all have the same agenda. I don't think so. I think there are different sides of this debate. Brzezinski perhaps taking the side that some form of soft power will be able to accomplish the dominance that's needed, and someone like perhaps a Dick Cheney or a Armitage or some or Richard Pearl or Douglas Feith, others who have been associated with that same Chamber of Commerce, would take the opposite position that military power and covert operations and these types of things would have to happen. So I think there are definitely two different competing viewpoints, and it's not necessarily that. I think Zbigniew Brzezinski lays it out very convincingly, the 21st century version of Mackinder's heartland theory, basically that Eurasia and Central Asia in particular is still the heartland that needs to be dominated. But the question is how to dominate it, and it's not at all clear that everyone has the same answer to that.
Not so much on that side, so then we continue here, and then we go back.
Come on, guys!
Or did I miss? No, that is a silent side. Okay, well, I ignore them then.
No, I'll just turn this way.
Yep, there.
Yes, let me start by thanking you for this lecture. It's quite a lot of information to process.
Yeah, you can re-listen to it multiple times next week.
I will. I have a follow-up question to the first and the second question. The second was about National Socialists. The first was about ISIL. What about Ukraine, since there are ultra-nationalists active as well. Do you think there's enough evidence to support the claim that NATO is indeed using a Gladio-like network to mobilize them against Russia?
There is evidence. There is evidence. Whether it's convincing evidence or not, I'll let you decide. But you'll remember in February, there was a sniper attack that took place in Ukraine at the protests that resulted in the deaths on both sides. And it was not at all clear where this sniper attack came from or what was happening. There have been reports, I believe William Engdahl, who was going to speak here last week, but unfortunately did not, I believe he was citing intelligence sources that he had, that I don't believe he named, that those forces were specifically groups that were affiliated perhaps in the past at some point with NATO Gladio. And I don't remember the specific details of the name of the group or what have you, but that can hopefully be looked at up fairly easily online for William Engdahl, Ukraine sniper, something like that. But there have been pieces of that puzzle that have been pieced together that might directly relate to Gladio operations. Again, I'll let you decide if those pieces of the puzzle are convincing to you.
I think including the foreign affairs ministers of Estonia or something like that, he made also a claim that people were shooting to both sides at that moment, and that disturbed him, and then we never heard anything about it.
Right, which we should once again underline is the idea of the strategy of tension. Why? Who would want to shoot on both sides of that conflict? Who would hate everyone? No, it's that they're trying to create the the next stage of the conflict in order to up the game so that it becomes something different so that you can bring in whatever type of solution you want.
More questions? Okay, let's go. No, let's go this way. Yeah, and then there.
If the region is so important, well, first of all, thank you for the lecture. But if the region is so important, would you not expect that next to the United States and NATO, that also the other dominant players in the region would have the same kind of operations? And would that not also? My question is, have you looked at that? And are they also as apparent as what we see from, because it kind of like looks a little bit...
One-sided?
Yes.
Yeah. No, I agree, and I think that's an important point. I haven't looked specifically at Russian secret service operations in the area or that type of thing, but there are certainly, there are those who would argue that this form of strategy, the strategy of tension and the use of espionage and subterfuge and sabotage and these types of events are almost characteristic of the British. In fact, from what I understand, although I do not speak many languages, but many European languages have a term for those perfidious English people, le perfide Albion and things like this. So it's different in every language. But this is supposedly famous, and it would tie into the old great game of the 19th century where, for example, if you read Rudyard Kipling's Kim, it's all about Kim O'Hara, who's a young Irish boy growing up in India, but an orphan, and he basically is able to blend in with the local population, and everyone kind of assumes he's Indian anyway. So he becomes kind of the perfect spy for the British side, and it's all about him trying to steal the maps and things from Russian generals in the area and that type of thing. So that was specifically something that was kind of the old great game was famous for, was kind of, again, on the British side of things, that type of thing. And again, I don't know the history of the Russian side of espionage in that area in the old great game. It's not something that I've come across. But I think it's an important point and something to look into. I think we'd be naive to believe that the Russian and the Chinese and Iranians don't have an interest in this region and wouldn't try to do something in order to maintain that domination. But there's an even deeper level to this, which I don't know if we can even bring this in, but why not? There are pieces of this puzzle that, for example, the Russian government must know about, simply must know about. One of those tantalizing clues, which, by the way, is available in that series of interviews that I conducted with Sibel Edmonds last year. If there's anyone in this crowd who hasn't watched that series of interviews, or read the transcript that's now available on my website under the Articles tab, please do so, because that has as much information as was in today's presentation many times over. And one of the key points that came up again and again in that conversation was that the Russian government has certain pieces of this puzzle that they presumably could put out as evidence to expose these types of operations, and yet have not done so. One example of that was a fascinating incident from Ayman al-Zawahiri's career. I believe in 1996, he was actually arrested and apprehended by the FSB in Russia and held for a period of months, I believe, several weeks anyway. And he, during that time, was not, apparently, supposedly, not identified by the FSB, and his belongings were taken and searched, I believe, including a laptop. But for some reason, the FSB just couldn't find a translator to translate all the information on there, so they just let him go. What are you gonna do? Ayman al-Zawahiri. Again, there are pieces of this puzzle that the Russian government knows about, and it happens time and again. Chechnya, there's people with Turkish passports and other foreign passports that are caught and killed amongst the fighters. There have been Russian assassination teams that have found their way to Istanbul to kill people that were involved in the Chechen operations. So they know that this subterfuge is happening, but they've never presented it in an open stage. Why not? I don't have the answer to that. I really don't. But it's a fascinating thing to think about, and I think absolutely deserves more scrutiny in the hopefully open source investigation that will take place from here. Thank you.
I think one thing that is really important here is that we have a free press here, and that, of course, what kind of free press? Okay, free-ish press. But anyway, that makes it much easier to find all kinds of little tidbits, because in countries like China and Russia, the information is much more controlled.
Yes. Yeah, so we laugh, but honestly, you cannot type Tiananmen Square into a search engine in China and get any results. I mean, that is an actual explicit piece of censorship that we don't experience in that same way. So yes, you're right.
The following question was then, if that is not to be found or lesser to be found, couldn't it not be that there is a higher, let's say, that point at multinationals, for instance, that have lesser of a nationalistic or bloc association but are far more economically driven, and as a result that use all kinds of parties in order to further their interests?
That would be exactly my inclination. That would certainly be what I would be looking for in the evidentiary record. If this is known about by the Russians but is not being used, then is this part of a plan that is operating exactly as it's meant to operate? And is this not being exposed because it's not meant to be exposed? And if that's the case, then there must be a higher level than what we would think of. Which relates back to my last podcast, episode 297, for those of you who want to check it out. It's called China and the New World Order. And it discusses this idea, which I think is very apt to this presentation. Basically, the idea that the nation-state battles for resources that we see going on at one level of this global chessboard are not what we think of when we look at some of these players who are connected across these different organizations. So if we can start finding elements of the Russian oligarchy or the Chinese oligarchy or other oligarchies that are connected with some of these same players, we might see a very different picture emerging, and it gets very deep at that point.
I have a question on the other side, and I would love to hear the other side.
Finally. All right. Would these organizations have anything to do with the central banks of all over the world?
Yes. If I could answer in a word, yes. Specific tie-ins to central banks do not come to mind at the moment, but I mean central banks as the mechanism underpinning the economy of all of these various nations obviously plays a role. And something that would be interesting to check into, for example, would be membership of some of these countries in various organizations and whether those memberships start or end at various times. So one that would come to mind in the central banking context would be the Bank for International Settlements. Is Uzbekistan a member? I don't know off the top of my head. Is Kazakhstan a member of the Bank for International Settlements, the central bank of central banks that coordinates the central banks throughout much of the world? It's a very good question. And from those types of organizations, we might be able to identify specific people who might tie in with some of these events or some of these other people. Again, that's a fruitful area of investigation. Just on that note of membership of various organizations, I mentioned the CSTO, the NATO counterbalance, towards the end of that that presentation. If you look at the membership of CSTO, Azerbaijan, and I want to say Uzbekistan, but I stand to be corrected on that, both left the Azerbaijan and another, Kazakhstan? I think Kazakhstan, left the organization in 1999, and I believe Uzbekistan left in 2012, something along those lines. Please check that to make sure I'm quoting that correctly. But they left those organizations, for example, precisely at the time, as we know, Azerbaijan was shifting over towards the Western side rather than towards the Russian side that it had formerly been on. It shifted out of the CSTO, and Azerbaijan, of course, now on track to become a NATO member. So we can track some of these movements on the chessboard through things like the membership in organizations like this.
All right, we have time for another question. Oh, there, yeah.
Can you say something about the role of Ron Paul in all these things? Ron Paul is a right winger, I think, member of the Tea Party, isn't it? And he says, get out of the Ukraine. Can you, I'm not an American,
I should stress I'm not an American either, for anyone who doesn't know. I'm Canadian, but I concentrate a lot on American politics, so fair enough. I know that Ron Paul has made statements of that ilk. I don't think I've actually listened to his statements, so I can't comment on them in detail, but I know it was broadly part of his election campaign in 2008 and 2012, kind of a bring the troops home mentality and a less engagement in foreign affairs generally and less engagement militarily around the world. So I think broadly speaking, that seems to be exactly counter to the Brzezinski and Kissinger and Cheney and Armitage and all these people. They have their own splits. They argue about soft power and military domination and covert operations, but there's the other side that's arguing that, well, we need to withdraw presence entirely, which... Sorry?
Has he a relation with the Koch brothers? Koch, auf dem deutschen Blatt.
Koch. Oh, the Koch brothers. I honestly don't know specifically if there are ties between Koch brothers and...
Yes, there are, but I don't know them, but by heart.
Okay.
It comes to mind. Someone is talking about it all the time, but I forgot which podcast.
Your program brings to mind university research of the deeper levels of the goings-on of the war. Of Yugoslavia. There was a Canadian professor who had a study program which proved that there was a political agenda to destabilize Yugoslavia because it was, in fact, almost paradise and a region of stability there, and that blocked our interests. Are you of his ilk? And then, connected to that, who are the people who try to debunk you?
Mm, very good question. You? I don't know.
not yet.
Okay. I honestly, the Yugoslav wars are a great gaping gap in my personal knowledge. I have never given an investigative report on them. I have never put a lot of detailed research into them. I cannot speak about them with any authority.
But you know who I'm talking of.
It's Canadian professor, you mean Michel Chassidovsky?
It's a very broad program from the University of Toronto or...
I assume Michel Chassidovsky.
Ottawa.
Yeah. Yes, I am certainly familiar with Michel Chassidovsky. I work with him at the Global Research Center for Global Research.
You're of his ilk.
Yeah. Sorry?
You're of his ilk.
Well, we agree on some things. We disagree on others. But... I have not personally done research on the Yugoslav wars enough to comment on.
And are there debunkers of you?
Of course, yeah.
Can you name some?
I don't know specifically people arguing against me. I know people arguing against the ideas that I advocate. What springs to mind is statements like a Graham Fuller being quoted in the Washington Post saying, no, Gulen CIA connections? That's ridiculous. Meanwhile, he's writing reference letters for Gulen to stay in the country. But I would say, I would hope that everyone in this room is a potential debunker of me. I would hope everybody in this room is, if not motivated by, at least encouraged to debunk various parts of this puzzle that are wrong, because I don't want to be standing on quicksand. I'd prefer to be standing on bedrock. And I know that I don't know everything about this. I completely do not know everything about this. I don't speak Turkish or Azerbaijani or any of these languages that would be exceptionally important in coming to a better understanding of some of these source documents. So I 100% concede that this is not a finished report in any manner. And that's why there is a corporate report community, and that's why obviously anyone can participate anywhere they want, anywhere on the internet, in bringing more information to this table.
Okay, yeah. In the back. And
thanks for being here. I have more like a general question. Mm-hmm. How do you deal in your personal life by telling this kind of information to people? Because in the Netherlands, everything seems quite peaceful, so when you tell people, they just find it very hard to understand that things are going on. Maybe somewhat nefarious. So
Once again, the question.
Yeah, how do you deal with telling this kind of information to your family and personal?
Yes. Well, it can be very controversial information. Luckily, I have never had problems with my family with regards to this information. I mean, I'm sure there are different things that they might disagree with me on, but it's never rancorous disagreement. And with my friends, there are certainly friends who agree with various things that I believe, disagree with others, people who disagree with me totally. But I don't ever try to push this information in someone's face and say, you believe this or you're not my friend or something like that. I mean, I guess there would be certain things that I would say if you were a psychopathic, crazy murderer or something. You probably can't be my friend. But no, I mean, I don't see my interrelations with normal human beings in my everyday life as being contingent on agreement or disagreement with various pieces of things that I advocate. And I think it's obviously this is the type of information that can really passionately hook people, so it can cause passionate disagreement. I understand that. But I am not the type of person who's going to passionately shove this down someone's throat until they accept it. So it hasn't really been a huge problem with me in my personal life, I could say.
Let's go that way. At the back first. Yeah.
Who do you want to give to?
Oh, I thought you... Well, there was a question there, wasn't there?
Yeah, I had a question as well. Yeah.
Okay, well, please ask.
Hi, James. First, thank you of all very much for your very independent and work of your journalism. I hope that everybody knows that James works only on donations. So if you have any donation you want to donate, you can do this in person.
I didn't pay him to say that. I really didn't.
But he's not paid by any big companies or medical institutions or whatever think tanks. So he relies 100% on the public for his funding. And that's, I think, it's very important for his integrity. I have a question. It's related to money as well. We heard your wonderful presentation tonight, and I find it myself very interesting. But I'm kind of short of on cash myself, so I want to have some investment advice. So how can I turn in this information into some money? Maybe buy some shares.
Buy shares in NATO. Yeah.
Very good. Very good. Here's my tip: you can never go broke betting on the military-industrial complex. Go with Boeing, go with Lockheed Martin, you know, just bet with all of those companies. You're going to make tons of money. Until we turn it around and we bring down the covert operations and the people who are puppeteering them and the companies that are profiting from them to the tunes of billions of dollars, in which case your investments will plummet into the ground and I will laugh all the way to the bank. Not the bank. The non-bank.
Yes, thank you very much, James.
Yes, thank you.
Yep.
I have two questions. My first one is, have you ever noticed that the government is working against you in some way? And my second question is, what are your political views?
We got about 6 or 7 hours. Is the government working, do I know if the government is working against me in some way? I can honestly say that I don't know of any specific anything, agents, operatives, whatever. I met a very interesting person at a 9/11 truth conference in Osaka, but I don't know. Probably not. I don't know. I mean, everyone thinks that when you get involved in this, it's all going to be cloak and daggers and all sorts of crazy things are going to happen, but I haven't experienced that. And when something goes wrong and Skype cuts out, I don't necessarily think it's the NSA. Having said that, I would be surprised if there was not some sort of surveillance on what I do, if only because I'm in contact with people like NSA whistleblower Russell Tice and people like this who absolutely 100% are being monitored. So, I mean, there has to be some sort of linkage there. But I don't know specifically of any operations to disrupt what I'm doing. I like to think I'm not important enough. Because I like to think, again, what I'm doing is not particularly groundbreaking. What I'm doing is just collecting stuff that's already open out there in the open and putting it together in some sort of narrative that hopefully makes sense and hopefully spurs some recognition and interest. and gets people involved, but I don't think that's groundbreaking enough. But again, I don't know. The second question, what are my political views? I guess the simplest way to answer that would be to say to go to CorbettReport.com and go to the search bar on the right-hand side of the page and type in anarchy. Or more accurately, voluntarism. Yes. But, but that's a mouthful. So anyway, yes. I mean, that would be the short form answer. But hopefully we can discuss that in more detail later.
All right, after this answer. No, I have to close, I'm afraid. Leaves me two things to do. One is that James produces an awful lot of media, and he burned some of that media on DVDs. And a few of them are available at the back, I guess?
Maybe at
somewhere
the front.
Here-ish?
Yes,
yeah?
Why not,
okay.
Directly.
So they're for 15 euros, and they probably contain hours and hours and hours of media.
Well, let's not get carried away. It's a two DVD set of my Federal Reserve documentary.
Ah, oh, yeah.
Yes,
okay. Sorry.
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
Two and a half hours.
2.5 hours. Well, this is hours and hours and hours. And, well, finally, James, I would like to thank you for all of us, and especially also from the Studium Generale. And we always have a book.
Oh.
So we also have a book for you this time.
Excellent.
It is a translation of a Dutch book. It is fiction. And, well, maybe you find the time in the aircraft to read some fiction.
May I open it?
Yes, please open it. Yeah.
I feel like Christmas. I have no idea what this is, but thank you.
It is good. Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay, James.
Thank you very much.
Again, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Thank you to each and every one of you.